content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen. We thank them for their support. And as I get adjusted to a different studio, I apologize for the false start there. The ill-fated idea to move the nation's capital to St. Louis. In the years after the Civil War, some wanted a new seat of government that would be closer to the geographic center of a growing nation. By Livia Gershon. The U.S. House of Representatives will likely pass legislation calling for the District of Columbia to become the 51st state. It marks the farthest the push for D.C. statehood has gone in more than 200 years of its existence. The bill's fate in the U.S. Senate is unclear, though its prospects for passage are mixed at best. One of the consistent objections raised by legislation opponents is that the residents of D.C. have an undue influence on Congress. Merits aside, unspoken by these opponents is a 160-year-old idea. Disassemble the Capitol building, the White House, and the rest of the district's government buildings, and ship the entire headquarters of the federal government to the middle of the country. More specifically, St. Louis, Missouri. An absurd premise, perhaps, but one that was given a close look in the years after the U.S. Civil War. They imagined they would move the real buildings themselves, says Adam Aronson, a historian at Manhattan College in Riverdale, New York, and author of The Great Heart of the Republic, St. Louis and the Cultural Civil War. The image is kind of fantastical, but also intriguing. The idea of numbering the blocks of the Capitol building for reassembly hundreds of miles away was very much of its time. The whole thing is only thinkable in the aftermath of the Civil War, when you have had these kinds of massive logistical innovations, and when they've moved so many people, but also so much stuff around on the railroads, says Walter Johnson, historian at Harvard University and author of The Broken Heart of America, St. Louis and the Violent History of the United States. The fact that many people at the time could imagine that this might really work also suggests just how much the nation was in flux following the war. Johnson notes that D.C. may have seemed less inevitable as the nation's capital, given that Richmond, Virginia, the center of the Confederacy, had just hoisted a capital that a lot of people believed was a real capital. This was a nation that had just faced a very real threat to its continued existence, and fundamental aspects of its character were still in question. Would freed African-American men be permitted to vote? Would white Southerners who had taken up arms against the country be allowed back into political life? How would the much-anticipated completion of the Transcontinental Railroad rearrange the economy? How far could white settlers go in expanding their presence across the continent? In some ways, Aronson says, St. Louis was at the heart of these questions. Geographically, it was located where North, South, and West came together. It had been a slave state, but had not seceded. It was central to many railroad lines, and it was growing at a remarkable pace. It would rise from the country's 24th most populous city in 1840 to the fourth biggest in 1870. No one was more convinced of the importance of St. Louis than local businessmen and booster Logan Uriah Revis. Revis was a remarkable man with a remarkable appearance. He wore a long, messy red beard and walked bent over, a cane due to childhood illness. Born in Illinois in 1831, he failed in his early career as a schoolteacher when the students ridiculed him ceaselessly, according to Aronson's book. In 1866, he arrived in St. Louis intent on starting a newspaper and elevating the image of his adopted hometown. Revis wasn't the first to suggest the city as a new capital for the nation. In 1846, St. Louis newspapers claimed that the move would be necessary to govern a country that grew significantly in size after the end of the Mexican-American War. But Revis may have been the most outspoken supporter of the cause. He presciently envisioned, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, envisioned a United States stretching not just out to California, but up to Alaska and down to the Gulf of Mexico. And he saw St. Louis as the obvious place for the government of this mega United States, the great vitalizing heart of the Republic. In contrast, he wrote, Washington was a distant place on the outskirts of the country with little power or prestige. Washington was also kind of a mess at the time. People had been complaining for decades about its alternately dusty and muddy streets and the swarms of mosquitoes that infested the capital. Its population in 1860 was just 75,080, less than half of St. Louis's. During the Civil War, it grew dramatically with a heavy military presence and a growing population of black Americans who had escaped enslavement in the Confederacy. To accommodate its growing size, some congressmen introduced new spending bills that would pay for updates to the city's infrastructure. In response, between 1867 and 1868, three House representatives from the Midwest proposed resolutions to move the capital toward the middle of the country. As historian and educational publisher Donald Lenkowitz writes for History Net, the first two of these stalled in the Ways and Means Committee, but a third, introduced by Wisconsin Representative Herbert Payne in February 1868, came to a vote on the floor. Eastern congressmen saw the proposal to move the seat of government to somewhere in the valley of the Mississippi as a joke, but it shocked them with the amount of support it received, ultimately failing by a vote of just 77 to 97. The notion of St. Louis as the new capital got another life in July 1869, when Chicago Tribune editor Joseph Medill published an editorial supporting the idea. Although the two cities were rivals in some respects, Medill believed that shifting the nation's center of gravity west would benefit Chicago, too. Instead of the Potomac, the capital would overlook the Mississippi, so appropriately expressive of the broader tide, the deeper flow, the longer current, and the resistless force of our national development had attained since that early day when the tabernacle of the government was set up amidst the solitudes of the Potomac, he wrote. Local St. Louis boosters promoted the idea enough to prompt land speculation around the Jefferson Barracks area, a former U.S. Army training post south of the central city, which was considered the most likely site for the federal buildings. Former Congressman Henry T. Blow even offered to donate 500 acres of land for the Capitol grounds, as long as he could also build housing for federal employees nearby. Beyond local advocacy, moving the Capitol rode a wave of interest among Republicans uninterested in their political allies' embrace of the radical Reconstruction vision of a multiracial democracy. These politicians, Aronson said enough had been done for ex-slaves and wanted the country to get back to promoting the interests of Americans. These included Joseph Pulitzer, who, before starting his career as a newspaper publisher, served as a Missouri state representative, and German immigrant Carl Schurz, who became a senator, a U.S. senator, in 1869. Schurz went on to become Secretary of the Interior, promoting the elimination of Native American nations and the integration of indigenous peoples into the U.S. mainstream. Johnson says that one indication of the way the effort to move the capital was tied to a broader imperial project. Many St. Louis boosters hoped to channel the nation's energies into the settlement of and extraction of resources from the West. In a way, it's in the West that the North and South, the White North and the White South, are reconciled after the war, he says, at the expense of African Americans and Native Americans. In October of 1869, Revis, Blow, and other supporters of the capital removal cause hosted a national convention. According to HistoryNet, delegates arrived from 17 states and territories. They declared their opposition to federal spending on improvements in Washington and declared that the convenient, natural, and inevitable place for the capital of the Republic is in the heart of the valley, where the center of population, wealth, and power is inevitably gravitating. But of the original 13 colonies, the only state to send a delegation was Pennsylvania, suggesting the limited geographical appeal of the cause. A second convention the following year in Cincinnati drew delegates from even fewer states, and organizers had little progress to report. Gradually, support for turning St. Louis into the nation's new capital faded away. The savvy political actors realize after some movement that it's not going to happen and move on to other ways to create power for themselves, Aronson says. Revis remained a true believer, but found himself increasingly alone in his ideas. He ends up penniless, Aronson says. Of course, the failure of the cause didn't stop the westward movement of U.S. power. In 1874, Civil War hero William T. Sherman moved the headquarters of the Army from Washington to St. Louis, making it a base for his campaign to seize Native Americans' land and protect railroad and mining interests. He felt, I guess, freer to pursue a kind of military exterminationist policy from St. Louis than he did from Washington, Johnson says. And in what Johnson calls an emblematic moment in 1877, the troops that pulled out of the South, ending the Reconstruction era, ended up protecting railroads in the West. While the effort to move the capital may have faded away quickly and might sound absurd to us now, Aronson and Johnson say there could have been some real advantages if it had actually happened. A St. Louis capital might have countered some of the imbalance created by the concentration of powerful institutions in coastal cities. It is sometimes hard for people on the coast to understand the depth of alienation that people in the middle of the country, of all kinds, feel around the notion of flyover country, Johnson said, and the way they feel detached from the dominant institutions in society. Like Revis, some may still see Washington, D.C. as a distant place on the outskirts of the country, far from its great vitalizing heart. Keeping you current, the oldest olive oil ever found is 8,000 years old. Chemical analysis unveil traces of olive oil in ancient Israeli pottery. By Colin Schultz, Smithsonian Magazine. The Al-Badawi olive tree in Bethlehem, which researchers peg to somewhere between 4,000 and 5,000 years old, is likely the oldest living olive tree in the world. Though the tree is exceedingly old, in this ancient region of the Middle East, the practice of squeezing oil from olives is even older. According to new archaeological research, the people were producing olive oil in the region as far back as 8,000 years ago, says the Times of Israel. In a dig at the site of the Bronze Age town of Ein Zippori, Einzippori, just over a mile west of Nazareth, researchers unearthed shards of broken pottery containers. According to Live Science, chemical analysis of the pottery shards revealed the traces of ancient olive oil. To make sure the ancient vessels once held olive oil, the researchers compared the chemical residues left on the ancient clay to those from a modern-day clay sample with one-year-old olive oil inside. The analysis of the two were remarkably similar, they found. Of the nearly two dozen pottery containers found at the site, two dated around 5,800 BC, says the Times of Israel. According to the researchers in their study, the find pushes back by several centuries the onset of olive oil production. Finding olive oil in ceramic containers from Ein Zippori, together with the finds from Kfar Samir, S-A-M-I-R, at least teaches us that the storage of vegetable oil, and especially olive oil, was a routine custom and had a major role in the diet of the pre-Gasaluian population, and that is spelled G-H-A-S-S-U-L-I-A-N. According to the Times of Israel, the find may mark the earliest known case of olive oil production in the Mediterranean basin. Colin Schultz wrote that. He's a freelance science writer and editor based in Toronto. He blogs for Smart News and contributes to the American Geophysical Union. And coming up next, experts answer eight key questions about COVID-19 vaccine reactions. Medical professionals weigh in on why some individuals have different responses to the shots and offer advice on what to expect. By Emily Mullen. If you've gotten a COVID-19 vaccine already, and I hope you have, you may have found yourself comparing your side effects with vaccinated family members and friends, or turning to Google to check if the symptoms you're experiencing are normal. Now, with more than 131 million individuals in the United States have received at least one vaccine dose, and more than 84 million individuals, more than 25% of the population, are fully vaccinated, researchers are getting a clearer picture of the potential reactions that can occur after getting a COVID-19 vaccine. Many recipients experience mild side effects like arm soreness, fatigue, headache, or a low-grade fever, while others may have no side effects at all. Severe side effects like those that Gregory Pollan suffered are less common. Pollan, a physician and vaccinologist at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester, Minnesota, was unlucky enough to come down with the uncontrollable shaking and chills for several hours after getting the shot. He's also one of a small number of individuals who have reported severe ringing in their ear following vaccination. In very rare cases, a half dozen women have developed severe blood clots after receiving the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Although the distribution of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine have been paused out of an abundance of caution, it's important to know that the vast majority of other vaccine reactions aren't cause for concern. In fact, it's perfectly normal that some recipients have stronger reactions than others. Vaccine reactions are not evidence of something gone wrong, but evidence of something going right, Pollan says. Why do vaccine reactions happen at all? Vaccine reactions happen because your immune system is mounting a response to an antigen, a molecule that looks like part of a virus. The antigen used in COVID-19 vaccines is a version of a protein on the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Moderna and Pfizer vaccines tell your cells to make this program using a tiny, rather make this protein using a tiny piece of genetic material called mRNA. By contrast, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine uses an engineered virus to shuttle a gene that codes for this protein. Your immune system treats this protein like an invader, Pollan explains. If you've never been infected with a virus like SARS-CoV-2, your body doesn't know how to fight it off. As a result, the virus can slip past your immune system and infect your cells. Vaccines help train your immune system to recognize a pathogen like SARS-CoV-2 so that when it encounters it later, it's ready to attack it. Many vaccines require two doses to do this effectively. The first dose of a vaccine introduces the immune system to a specific antigen. This priming shot triggers an initial immune response, and the body starts making antibodies against the antigen. The Johnson & Johnson vaccine only requires one dose because it elicits a strong immune response. For the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, this initial immune response isn't as robust. A second booster shot is needed to kick the immune system in high gear. This immune response is stronger than the first one, and as a result, it often produces worse side effects. How do the reactions to the different COVID-19 vaccines differ? Side effects across the Moderna, Pfizer, and Johnson & Johnson vaccines are very similar. The two types of side effects you might experience are local and systematic. Local side effects, meaning in the arm where you got the shot, include pain, redness, or swelling. Systematic side effects, those that happen throughout the rest of your body, may include tiredness, headache, muscle pain, chills, fever, and nausea. On April 13, federal health officials called for a pause in the use of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine after reports that six women developed a type of blood clot after vaccination. One of the women died, and another one is in critical condition. To date, close to 7 million individuals in the U.S. have gotten this vaccine. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention says the blood clots appear to be extremely rare. A CDC advisory panel postponed a decision on the use of Johnson & Johnson's vaccine until it investigates the cases. Why do individuals have such different reactions to COVID-19 vaccines? Put simply, we all have different immune systems. Our immune system is made up of two layers of defense, the innate and adaptive immune systems. The innate immune system is the one we're born with, meaning it's heavily influenced by our genetics. Our adaptive immune system, meanwhile, evolves over time. It's shaped by the pathogens and other substances in the environment that we're exposed to over the course of our lives. When you get the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, your innate immune system is the first to respond. Some individuals can have stronger reactions to a vaccine because their immune system is just hardwired that way. Some people's innate immune system is more reactive to certain stimuli, but not to the extent that it's bad for you, says Nicholas Pullen, an immunologist and associate professor of biological sciences at the University of Northern Colorado. colon is among those whose immune systems overreacted to the vaccine. In doing so, his immune system released more immune signals, or chemicals known as cytokines, C-Y-T-O-K-I-N-E-S, and chemokines, than the average person. Everyone's immune system generates different levels of these chemicals based on what our bodies think we need. Some individuals release more of these chemicals than necessary, while other individuals have a more balanced immune response. The release of the chemicals alerts the adaptive immune system to the threat. Over the next several days to few weeks, the body builds up its adaptive immunity to the pathogen. The second dose of the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines then boosts the adaptive immune system's memory response to the virus. Very interesting. Are certain groups more likely to have side effects than others? Younger adults are reporting more side effects from COVID-19 vaccines. Pullen says that's probably because they tend to have more robust immune systems than older adults. Women also report women also have thicker fat pads at the deltoid muscle. Let me back up a little bit here. For one, women tend to have stronger immune responses than men do. Most of the immune response genes are located on the X chromosome. Typically, biologically female individuals are born with two X chromosomes, which means double the number of these genes compared to men. Women also have thicker fat pads in the deltoid muscle, the part of the upper shoulder where the vaccine is injected. Muscles have a lot of blood vessels, which allow an injected vaccine to be absorbed and carried throughout the body more quickly. But sometimes healthcare workers mistakenly inject the vaccine into the fat instead of the muscle, which can trigger an inflammatory response. Because fat tissue retains injected material for much longer, it's more susceptible to adverse effects caused by that injection. What can I do to mitigate side effects before taking the vaccine? Pullen recommends that individuals stay hydrated, eat properly, get enough sleep before their vaccine appointments. All of those things affect the health of our immune system. You should, you should avoid taking pain relievers before your shot because these medications may blunt the body's immune response to the vaccine. You also shouldn't get a COVID-19 vaccine at the same time as another vaccine, like the flu or shingles, according to the CDC. And ladies and gentlemen, that wraps up our time here for Smithsonian. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Kappen, and we thank them for that support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I've enjoyed bringing it to you. And don't forget those podcasts on our website. You can listen to hundreds, if not thousands, of them.